Good afternoon. You're listening to WUTC 88.1 FM, Essential News, Eclectic Music, Every Day. What you're hearing right now sounds like some sort of avant-garde piano composition. This is actually the music of a tree. It relates to a new book called The Songs of Trees by regional author David George Haskell. He's a professor of biology at the University of the South in Suwannee. And coming up in just a moment, on a very special weekend edition of Around It About Chattanooga, we'll be speaking with Haskell. He's going to be here in Chattanooga to talk about the book on April 18th. Stay tuned.
We are nearing the end of the first 100 days of the Trump administration. The news is not taking a break.
I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions.
Obamacare remains the law of the land for the
first Judge Gorsuch year. Is going to be confirmed.
You can count on NPR News to go beyond talking points, to demand clarity rather than confusion. Stand with the facts. Listen to Morning Edition every day. Tune into Morning Edition weekdays 6 to 10 on WUTC.
Welcome to a special weekend edition of Around It About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. Coming up on the show, we're going to talk to David George Haskell about his new book, The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. Haskell is a biology professor at the University of the South in Suwannee, Tennessee. His first book, The Forest Unseen, was a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction. His new book is about, as the title would suggest, trees, the acoustics of trees, the music of trees, sometimes literally, and the way that trees connect to life itself as part of a network where the concept of an individual doesn't necessarily have as much meaning as it might in our everyday lives. First up, Haskell's going to read us an excerpt of The Songs of Trees. In this, he's talking about the Greek idea of kleos, fame, how it relates to songs, how those relate to trees, and how all this relates to why he wrote the book. Here's David Haskell.
For the Homeric Greeks, kleos, fame, was made of song. Vibrations in air contained the measure and memory of a person's life. To listen was therefore to learn what endures. I turned my ear to trees, seeking ecological kleos. I found no heroes, no individuals around whom history pivots. Instead, living memories of trees, manifest in their songs, tell of life's community, a net of relations. We humans belong within this conversation as blood kin and incarnate members. To listen is therefore to hear our voices and those of our family. Each chapter of this book attends to the song of a particular tree, the physicality of sound, the stories that brought sound into being, and our own bodily, emotional, and intellectual responses. Much of this song dwells under the acoustic surface. To listen is therefore to touch a stethoscope to the skin of a landscape, to hear what stirs below. I sought trees in places whose natures seemed quite different. The first chapters of the book comprise stories of trees that seem to live apart from humans. Yet these trees' lives and ours, past and future, are twined. Some of these connections are as ancient as life itself. Others are industrial reimaginings of older themes. I then turn to the exhumed remains of trees that have been long dead, fossils and charcoal. These ancients show the arc of biological and geologic stories, and attest, perhaps, to the future. The third group of chapters concerns trees that live in cities and fields. Humans appear to dominate. Nature seems absent or in abeyance. Yet, wild biological relationships permeate every being. In all these places, tree songs emerge from relationship. Although tree trunks seemingly stand as detached individuals, their lives subvert this atomistic view. We're all trees, humans, insects, birds, bacteria, pluralities. Life is embodied network. These living networks are not places of omnibenevolent oneness. Instead, they are where ecological and evolutionary tensions between cooperation and conflict are negotiated and resolved. These struggles often result not in the evolution of stronger, more disconnected selves, but in the dissolution of the self into relationship. Because life is network, there is no nature or environment separate and apart from humans. We are part of the community of life, composed of relationship with others. So the human nature duality that lives near the heart of many philosophies is, from a biological perspective, illusory.
That's David George Haskell reading from his new book, The Songs of Trees. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
The title, The Songs of Trees, that's not just poetic. You literally wrote a book about the sounds that trees make. How did this get started with your students?
Absolutely. This song is, this book, which is a song in of itself, this book started with the acoustic experience of trees and then delves into the stories that underlie those acoustic phenomena, those acoustic sensations. So I started this with teaching with my students at Suwannee. I teach a course in ornithology. We'd go outside and learn bird songs. How can you identify birds by ear? And through doing this particular practice with students, I came to realize myself that the trees were also singing. They had different voices. Each species has its own voice in the spring, in the summer, in the fall, in the winter. So almost as a joke, I told my students, well, now you've learned all these bird songs, learn to identify trees by ear. And the minute that came out of my mouth, I knew, okay, I've just set myself a task. And so from then on, I tried to attend more closely to the sounds of trees in the wind as the rain falls onto them, and their sonic dimensions that emerge from conversation with people, say in a city. People in the summertime gather under trees to talk. Vendors set up underneath the tree. These human sounds are also part of the tree's many songs, its many stories.
And you talk about 12 different trees, some right here in the Southeast, others halfway across the world. How did you choose the specific trees that you were going to go and listen to and make recordings and write about?
Well, it was a challenge. There are trillions of trees on the planet, and in no way does this book try to tell all their stories or to even give a coverage of all the interesting scientific or environmental dimensions of tree lives. Instead, I chose trees that had arrived in my life either through their presence in places that I was visiting often. For example, my work takes me through Manhattan quite a bit, and I decided years ago, if I'm going to be in Manhattan, I should make a friend of a tree. And I picked a tree, a rather ordinary-looking street tree in Manhattan, to visit every time I was there. So I've been there dozens of times, and often during each visit, I'll repeat the visit many times to a particular tree, stretched over a week or a few days. So that was a place that I was visiting often anyway. Others were places where I knew there was a convergence of interesting stories, the human story and the tree story coming together in a fascinating way. For example, in Jerusalem, olive trees surround the old city, and the olive trees have been part of human life in that region for thousands of years, since they were domesticated 6,500 years ago. And not only are human lives and tree lives connected there, but it's a connection that makes life possible for both the tree and people. Olives in that region are one of the few plants that yields lots of good, nutritious food in the form of olives and olive oil. And olives thrive in that part of the world mostly when people care for them through irrigation and pruning. And so there's this unity of what it takes to thrive for both people and the trees. And when big droughts come in, about 1,000 years ago, there was an enormous drought that hit the region and wiped olives and people off the land. It was a terrible time. That the clay tablets from that period record times of great drought and calamity. And then there are times of where people can twine their lives with trees in a much more productive way through agriculture and so forth.
And it seems like one of the fundamental premises of this book is the idea of life as a network, not individuals who are part of a network, but that life itself is a network. What does that mean?
So trees are a great example of this. A tree seems to be an individual. What could be more individualistic than a tree trunk sticking out of the ground? And yet that individuality turns out to be an illusion. The tree is a community. If you look at the leaf, the leaf is comprised of plant cells and fungal cells and bacterial cells. And without those bacterial and fungal partners within the leaf is quickly overrun by pathogens and can't withstand drought. So what seems to us at first to be an individual is actually a network of relationships, a community comprised of chemical conversations. The same is true in the roots. A plant root lives only in community, in connection with the other creatures in the soil. And so in biology, we have this strange paradoxal tension. Things seem to be arranged in a rather individualistic way. And yet when we look below the surface, individuals turned out to be comprised of networks. The same is true for the human body. If you take away all the bacteria in our guts and our skin, we are very sick. If you take them away during the developmental process for humans, we don't develop in the normal way. And so this is the revolution that I think is happening in biology now. We're understanding the importance of networks, and that the old view was that, sure, there are connections between organisms, but the fundamental unit of biology is the individual. Now we're seeing, well, the fundamental essence of biology is relationship and connection. Life is made from connection. It isn't just interconnected. Now, I should emphasize that these are two different metaphors, two different ways of thinking about life, and life is so huge and complex, no single idea or metaphor can capture it all. So I think of this notion of an individual-based view of biology versus a networked as two complementary views of looking at nature and understanding nature.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to a special weekend edition of Around It About Chattanooga. I'm Michael Edward Miller. I'm speaking to David George Haskell. He's a biologist. His new book is The Songs of Trees. Let's continue the conversation. In the Amazon rainforest, you talk to members of a tribe who very much have that idea of a community versus the individual. What did you find out?
So the Amazon, first of all, when I showed up there, the Amazon just blew me away with this sensory overload of sound and smells and diversity. This place in Ecuador is the most biodiverse place on the planet that we know of. Incredibly rich forest that is also threatened now by oil development. But the Guarani, the indigenous people of this part of the Amazon, who've lived there for thousands of years, have a networked view of their own society and their society in relation to other species. An individual name, for example, my name is David. It was given to me at birth, and I will stick with it all the way through. And you know, occasionally people change the entirety of their names. We change names through familial bonds and relationships through marriage. But usually there's this notion of continuity, particularly of our first names in our culture. Guarani culture, your name comes from the group. When you change groups, your old name dies, and you take on a name given to you by the new social group. And there is also an impossibility of return. Once your first name dies, you no longer have a presence within that group. The Guarani say they live like one. They don't think of themselves as being individuals. And the notion of, as we have in this country, of taking to the woods to be a solitary hermit, to receive wisdom and so forth, has no place in their understanding. The people who go to the woods alone are either sick or they're very angry. Either way, they're destined for death. Now, Guarani value autonomy and mastery of skills that are individual-based values. And yet those take place in the context of interconnections. And the tree in the Guarani creation story is the sabo tree, a huge tree that reaches over the top of the rainforest. It's such a tall tree that it towers over even the other tall rainforest trees. And this tree forms one of the chapters of the book, my studies of this tree. And all the interconnections that form in and around that tree are represented in the Guarani's understanding of the woods. And their culture is not, when I talk about this, it sounds very mystical and, you know, creation stories and changing names. It's what struck me was how practical it was, that their worldview is empirically based. Here is what the forest is like through our experience of thousands of years. And when we talk about networks and interconnections, we're not talking about spirituality and mysticism. We're talking about the reality. How do you get food from this forest? How do you make sure you're alive and your family group and larger social group can thrive?
That's David George Haskell. He teaches biology at Suwannee. We're talking about his new book, The Songs of Trees. You also visit a Bradford pear in Manhattan. And in that chapter, it's kind of talking about how the cityscape, the artificial landscape, the pavement, things like that, are all part of this tree's network and environment. What did you find out in Manhattan?
So Manhattan seems to be the exact opposite of the Amazon.
Yeah.
It's very urbanized, very dominated by human activities. And yet I found people in Manhattan were just as fiercely attached to their trees, for example, the tree outside an apartment complex, as the Guarani were to their sabo tree. So trees across the world, for people who pay attention, trees have very deep cultural significance, and we have emotional bonds to them. When a tree outside an apartment block is cut down, the people in that block, particularly those who've lived there for many years, feel a sadness and sometimes an outrage that how could this happen. So the tree on the sidewalk, this is true in Manhattan, it's an extreme example, but the same is true for street trees here in Chattanooga. Those trees take the city's life into their bodies. Literally, the way their wood grows responds to the vibratory environment, the sonic environment around them. If they're over a subway line or a place where diesel trucks are going past with a lot of vibratory sonic energy, those vibrations go into the wood, and I made some recordings of those from actually inside the wood of the tree. And as a growing tree is shaken, it actually toughens up its wood. And so city trees cling to the ground more tightly than their countryside cousins, because their roots have been strengthened by all these vibrations that surround them. The same is true for trees, say, on mountain ridges that are flexing in the wind. That movement, if it doesn't break the tree, makes it stronger. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. The same is true in trees. The other thing the trees do are taking atmospheric pollutants out of the air, absorbing it into their bodies and often detoxifying it. So they're connected to us through our lungs. Every breath of air we take in the city is connected to the trees in ways that actually mostly benefit the health of our lungs. Now, some of them also make pollen. They're reproductive individuals, and so some of us have some allergic reactions. It's not an unambiguously good relationship all the time. And now in springtime here in Chattanooga, with all the trees coming into bloom, lots of people are feeling those allergies. But at the same time, every time we breathe in, we're breathing oxygen that ultimately came from trees and from the oceans. So this idea of interconnectedness is, again, not an abstraction. Every single one of our breaths is connecting us to other creatures. And the sonic environment also is textured by trees. When you walk down a city street that has trees, tree branches reaching over it, the high frequencies are reflected back down because the wavelengths match the size of leaves. The low frequencies of sound pass right through those leaves. And so we get a slightly brighter sound. There's a little difference in the acoustic texture on a street that has trees than one that doesn't. The same is true with the aroma or the taste in the mouth of that city block that has trees on it. So trees enter our lives in all sorts of subtle ways that often we're not aware of. And then in less subtle ways, in that they're a source of joy to us as we see, for example, in a city where we don't see that much green, we see the buds breaking open, and our spirits are lifted when we think, finally, winter is over. This winter of our discontent is finally done. Here come the gorgeous, soft, green colors of springtime. So we have all kinds of connections. They're physical connections, they're sensory connections, they're intellectual connections to the trees. And then the tree is also deeply connected to our lives. One of the most fascinating things in Manhattan is their tree planting project for the last few years found that a tree that is planted just alone with no ceremony and just plucked in the ground and then left has a rather low probability survival. It's probably 50-50 whether it's still there in 10, 15 years. But if you plant that tree involving people from the neighborhood and put a little tag on the tree that says, "Hi, I'm a London plane tree. I'd appreciate it if you didn't let your dog poop here. If it's dry in the summer, please bring me a bucket of water." Just a very short little snippet of information, and you give it membership in the human community. You include it in the human social network. That tree's survival goes up to nearly 100% because it belongs to us and we have a relationship to it. So literally, its life partly depends on social network connections.
That's David George Haskell. We're talking about his book, The Songs of Trees. We'll have more in a moment.
What does the news each day mean for you?
Monthly jobs report.
Gorsuch was asked
for the travel ban.
Combat climate change.
NPR slows the news down with historical context and broad perspectives. Stand with the facts. Listen every day. Tune in to All Things Considered weekdays, 4 to 8 p.m. on WUTC.
You're listening to WUTC 88.1 FM. I'm Michael Edward Miller. You're listening to a special weekend edition of Around and About Chattanooga. I'm speaking with David George Haskell, a biology professor at the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee. His first book, The Forest Unseen, was a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction. His new book, just published this month, is The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. Haskell is going to be here in Chattanooga on April 18th at the Benwood Auditorium here on the campus of the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga for a talk that benefits the Tennessee Valley River Gorge Trust. Here's more of my conversation with Haskell, and because the book is so much about the sounds that trees make and some music he created based off the sounds of trees, he put some audio clips on his website for the book. We're going to hear some of those audio clips and talk about them now. In the website for your book, The Songs of Trees, you've got some recordings that you actually made. And let's hear the one of that tree in Manhattan. So how did you make that recording, and what is that actually the sound of?
So the sound is the sound from an accelerometer, which is a little device about the size of a bean that I placed up against the tree's bark. And instead of recording vibrations in air the way a microphone does, this picks up vibrations in a solid surface. Every single smartphone has one of these in it. It's how it detects whether you're turning it or shaking the phone and so forth. This is a much more sensitive one than is present in our smartphones. And so this little device picked up the vibrations in the tree's bark itself. And what we heard there were the sounds of the subway coming up through the ground. The subway is actually several stories down below the ground, right under the tree, as the express train thunders through there. It makes the ground shake. Those vibrations come up into the tree's trunk itself. The other sounds we hear, the chirps, are from some sparrows with very loud voices. These sparrows were hanging out in the tree making these calls and making just the surface of the tree vibrate where I had the accelerometer. I'd be very surprised if those sparrow chirps were loud enough to actually penetrate deeply into the wood.
One of the most unusual pieces of audio on the website, and let's hear a little bit of this right now.
This sounds like an incredibly abstract piano piece. What is this?
Yes, this is the piano practice from some sort of strange drug-induced trance. No, this is the sound of a maple twig. Speed it up. So it's we heard a clip from about a week of the life of a maple twig. And what I did was place a little sensor on this twig that measured how fat the twig was. And during the day, as water flows through the twig from the trunk out to the leaves and then into the air, the twig narrows down just a fraction of a hair. In the same way that when we suck on a straw, the straw is drawn in a little bit. So during the day when water is flowing, the twig contracts a little bit. And then at night, when the water ceases flowing and the twig fattens up with water, it swells just a little bit. So there's a daily cycle on a 24-hour cycle of the twig getting thinner and then fatter. I converted that into the sound of a little digital piano. The high-pitched sound are for the fatter twigs. And so we hear the high-pitched sound where the twig is at night, when it's wider. And then the low-pitched sounds are the sounds when the twig is much thinner, so during the day. So what we hear is a cycle of high-pitch to low-pitch, high-pitch to low-pitch. Sounds like crazy person going up and down the keyboard, up and down the keyboard. And then through the week, the twig is also adding wood. This is during the springtime. So the twig is getting thicker just because it's growing from a twig into a branch. And so the pitch that we heard goes up through the recording. So there's a daily cycle up and down, superimposed on that is an increasing pitch as the twig gets wider and wider. So this is a sonification of twig data. And this is happening all around us every day. When we walk down the street, the twigs have this pulse. It's almost analogous to a human heartbeat in that it's the flow of fluids through a living creature's vessels. And yet that heartbeat is not driven by the heart, our human heart, of course. It's driven by the energy from the sun, and it's on a much slower rhythm, just a 24-hour rhythm.
In Suwannee, you visit a tree that's fallen, that's died, and you talk about the process of death in the forest. Tell me about that.
This was a tree that just blew me away with how many things were happening at it. It was a very large ash tree that fell down in Shaycrack Hollow near Suwannee, about a meter across at its base, so it's a real giant. It smashed up a bunch of other trees as it fell. It fell because of a windstorm. After it, I was there just the day it fell. I could smell all of the torn leaves and so forth. And I made a commitment at that point. I'm going to follow this tree, keep visiting it as long as I can through my life to check in with its decomposition process. And I thought there would be some interesting things happen. But man, every time I go to that tree, there's another creature using that space. The bobcats travel down the log. They like to sit up on it to look around at the environment. The rattlesnakes curl up next to the log because there's lots of light and warmth coming down from the big hole in the tree canopy that the tree created as it fell. The rattlesnakes love that. They can warm up in the sun, as can the dragonflies and the hoverflies. The wildflowers are going crazy because there's more light, and so are the shrubs. And so insects and deer and other species are drawn to this log. So that the tree in its life was a catalyst for a lot of conversations and networked life. Trees bring all kinds of life into being. What I discovered was that the tree also has an afterlife that goes on for decades. It will take decades for this tree to decompose. And that afterlife is just as rich and as full of interconnections with other creatures as the first life of the tree. Now, after the tree has fallen, it no longer is quite as controlling. It's other creatures that are setting the conversation. But the tree is the nexus, is the node in this network, bringing new life into being in the forest.
And you talk about how it's almost like human grief, the way the forest reacts when this tree is suddenly gone.
Yeah, so in human grief, there's an analogy. It's not the same thing, of course. But in human grief, we have to let go of connections to people who are important to us. And in the forest, all those connections from the living tree are gone. when the tree falls. So all the creatures that depended on the living roots and the leaves have to find new life, or they themselves will die. And then what happens with the tree is in its second life, a whole new set of creatures take over, the fungi, the little insects that live in the puddles of water that form in the dead wood. All these new creatures take on a new life there. So human grief has a trajectory of letting go, and perhaps there's a second life in the afterlife. We, right here, we don't exactly know what that's going to be. In the forest, though, we can see the tree's afterlife unfolding before us. It's still a creature that brings together lots of connections around it, but they take a different form. So it's a period of transition. So the tree, because it's so enormous, takes many, many decades for all of that tree's material to suffuse into the rest of the forest. For human beings, our bodies are much smaller, and that process is of decomposition is generally more quiet and subtle, and takes place over a quicker time period.
Suwannee itself, the University of the South, what is important about that school for a biologist? What is unique about that place?
I would say a couple of things. One is there are 13,000 acres of mostly forested land there. And so anytime we want to teach about forests or even about poetry, it's not just about biology. A lot of our science and art and literature has formed over the centuries, over the millennia, in relation to what we now refer to as the outdoor world. We can just walk out of the classroom door and we're in the living laboratory, if you like, or in the place of contemplation and meditation on trees and wetlands. So we have an extraordinary land base that has been cared for over now more than 100 years by people who've really been very good stewards of the land. So there's a physical context, and then there's the context of the community of people at Suwannee. The foundation of the curriculum is the notion that one needs to have exposure and conversation across disciplines. So every student takes courses in literature as well as in science and quantitative reasoning and foreign languages and so forth. So there's an understanding from the get-go that all these different varieties of knowledge are in conversation with one another. We don't try to box ourselves into particular disciplines. And of course, the physical setting encourages that. One cannot go outside and think about wetlands, for example, or trees without thinking about the poets who've written about trees and the science of plant ecology. And then the policy-making situation that we're in now with politics and economics, what is the future of wetlands in the United States? That's partly a scientific question, but it's also a cultural and economic question. So trees in ecology draw together all sorts of life forms in their bodies, but within academia, they draw together all sorts of questions. So I would say that the thing that thrives most at Suwannee is this idea of connecting disparate strands into one place in a physical way, but also in a way that's embodied in the curriculum.
Your writing itself, critics have talked about that, the way your writing combines poetry and biology and takes science and scientific writing in a different direction than it normally goes in. Where did that come from?
I just try to sit down and tell the truth of the forest. And so my method of writing is to spend a lot of time in the woods trying to open my senses, really pay attention to what is the smell of this place and what am I hearing in the soundscape, and then to spend just as much time in the library reading up about the particular question that I'm writing about, for example, the biology of trees or the conservation of natural habitats in the southeastern United States. Read up what have economists written about this, what have biologists discovered in the last few years. And then to take that sensory experience and then the knowledge that we've gained through science and other disciplines and put them together in stories that are hopefully interesting for people to read. And what I love to do is to swim down into the verbs and the nouns and really find the best way of conveying a particular moment, really get that nice, juicy, apt word in there. And I think poets do this magnificently. I try to take some of that spirit and use it to convey some of the ideas bouncing around in my head and some of the discoveries I've made in the forest.
And I think that's one of the great things about writing, because with something like film, sure, you can actually see things, but you can't smell, you can't taste, you can't feel. And with writing, you can really convey those ideas.
Absolutely. I think writing is, in some ways, capturing the imagination, the consciousness of another person, and through the simplicity of its form, it's just inked words on a page. There's no extra sensory information there. We bring all that sensory information, all those ideas, into mind through the power of the human imagination. So an author provides the vehicle to do that, and then the reader's imagination is actually what is powering the experience. So I think of writing as in some ways catalytic. You're making possible something that the reader themselves are actually doing. I can put words on a page, but the experience itself is manifesting in somebody else's consciousness. It's their own neural network that is bringing that experience into being. And I would note that that process is often mediated with the help of trees. So what is a printed page?
Yeah.
It is a tree. And when we hear music, what are we hearing? Humans communicating to one another with the help of trees. In a violin or a guitar or a piano, is vibrating wood. And in some of my travels, I discovered this was also true in religious practices. In Japan, many of the Shinto and Buddhist temples, prayers are made and the attention of the world and of gods are drawn into the place by the sounds of wood. So wooden beads banging together, divination sticks, all kinds of wooden sounds serve as the conduit from the human realm to the more divine realm. And so in that particular culture, there is the wood plays this central bridging role. And that's true every time we listen to a piece of music or read a page in our own culture.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to A Roundabout Chattanooga, a special weekend edition. I'm Michael Edward Miller. That's David George Haskell. His first book, The Forest Unseen, was a Pulitzer finalist in 2013. His new book is The Songs of Trees, and he's going to be here in Chattanooga on April 18th for a lecture at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga in the Benwood Auditorium. Now we're going to talk to someone from the Tennessee River Gorge Trust. That's the organization benefiting from the lecture on the 18th. Sarah, let me get you to introduce yourself.
I'm Sarah Quattrochi. I'm Associate Director of the Tennessee River Gorge Trust, and we are just the beneficiary. Dr. Hill Craddock here at UTC actually is working with David to bring him here to UTC's campus Tuesday evening at the Benwood Auditorium, and we're fortunate enough to be working with him just to help promote and be recipients of the ticket sales to help local conservation in the River Gorge Trust, in the River Gorge.
And that's obviously what your organization does. What are some of the specific things that you're doing right now?
Oh, goodness. It's springtime, so all hands are on deck and doing different things. We have field technicians who are out on the land pretty much every day doing boundary marking. We own about 6,000 acres of property in the Tennessee River Gorge and protect other pieces through conservation easements. But we're getting up to speed on where we need to be with marking our boundaries so that people know how to identify where our property ends and others begin. We have several projects going on with bird research. So we have one particular graduate student, again at UTC, Holland Youngman. She's been working for a few years on a worm-eating warbler study. And then we have another young man named Elliot who is working on a Louisiana water thrush survey. We had geolocators that were released on 16 birds last year. Those birds are returning from their wintering in Central and South America to the River Gorge. And we've so far recaptured two of the 16 birds within a few hundred feet of where they were captured and geoed last year. So it's fun. We're just kind of in the middle of these processes to find the data. So we also have educational programming going on, opportunities for people to get out and explore the gorge, start this time of year through hiking and kayaking adventures and that kind of thing. So people can get involved in many different ways.
So you'll be here Tuesday, April 18th, again, here on the campus of the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. What are you planning to talk about?
I will be sharing some of the Songs of Trees, talking about the origin of this book, and sharing a few readings from the book, but also giving some of the backstory and some of the context of how I came to be fascinated by the lives of trees. And a particular emphasis of the book and also the talk is how human lives and tree lives are interconnected. And it's just a great honor for me to be able to do this as a benefit for the amazing work of the Trust, which has been now for more than 30 years in this region, has been protecting land and people's connection to the land right here close to Chattanooga.
It's really interesting to hear David talking to you about the book and just the deep, deep level of connection, because we know and we are always talking about how connected we are to our land and how important and integral open space is to our health as humans. But this level at which he's talking about and just observing, it's really fascinating to hear about. And it's exciting to allow the community to come be a part of that.
What is the website where people can get tickets?
trgt.org. So www.trgt.org. And our homepage has a link to the ticket link. It's $10 for general admission, $5 for students, and 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesday evening.
And what's the website for the book?
dghaskell.com. So I have a website that has information about the Songs of Trees, including some audio clips and photos and a Q&A. The website also has information about my first book, The Forest Unseen, and then some occasional what I call rambles, which are my little blog entries and Twitter posts.
What is your Twitter handle?
At DG Haskell.
Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having
us.
Again, that was David George Haskell. He'll be here in Chattanooga for a lecture on April 18th on the campus of the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga in the Benwood Auditorium. You can get tickets at trgt.org. That's trgt.org. His new book is The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors.
Around and About Chattanooga is a production of WUTC with contributions by the staff and volunteers of WUTC. Find us online at wutc.org.